users immediately contributed a total of $1,000. Elaine Block, for one, appreciates Raza and his moves. "We weren't laughing so much at him as much as we were laughing at ourselves," Block says. "We've all picked up a broomstick and waved it around like a lightsaber. That's why his video became so popular. It was funny and awkward, but ultimately we connected to him. He made us feel more comfortable with our own awkwardness, our own dreams of being a Jedi." At the end of the Golden Gate Knights class, Block gathers everyone into a circle. We sit meditation style, lightsabers balanced on their ends in front of us, painting our faces in the dark. Luminous beings are we. "Take some deep breaths," says Block. "Close your eyes. If you can't keep them closed, just look at your blade. We have a little Jedi oath, a mantra. So if you want to be a part of it, repeat after me." This is what we repeat. "There is no emotion. There is only stillness. There is no thought. There is only silence. There is no ignorance. There is only attention. There is no division. There is only perception. There is no self. There is only the Force." This mantra turns out to be the Jedi Code, or rather Block's version of it. There seems to be some disagreement on planet Star Wars about exactly what the Jedi Code is. At the Jedi Academy in Disney World, Orlando, instructors tell young Padawans to repeat the following Jedi Code before they are given their trainee lightsabers. "A Jedi uses the Force for knowledge and defense, never for attack. If I disobey these rules, into the crowd I will go back." The kids usually get very quiet on the last line. In Star Wars lore, the Jedi Code is supposed to go back to an ancient order that embraced both the dark and the light side of the Force, called the Jedi, which means mystic center, according to Wookiepedia, a crowdsourced online encyclopedia, and the code has since changed over time. Here is its best-known iteration, as used in a hip-hop track called Jedi Code by Rhapsody. "There is no emotion. There is peace. There is no ignorance. There is knowledge. There is no passion. There is serenity. There is no chaos. There is harmony. There is no death. There is the Force." Block says he changed his version of the code for two reasons. First, the original is licensed Lucasfilm material, and you do not want to mess with Lucasfilm on matters of copyright. Second, it didn't make a whole lot of sense. Couldn't you call peace a kind of emotion? The lack of passion is kind of a downer. Why rob yourself of that? Plus, that "there is no death" line might make the casual visitor think they'd stumbled into a religious cult. And if there's one thing we've learned about the Force, it's that it keeps resolutely refusing to turn into a religious cult. Several months after my first class with the Golden Gate Knights, I was asked to participate in Course of the Force, a charity relay race organized by the website Nerdist. It would charge runners with taking a single lightsaber from Lucas's Skywalker Ranch in Marin, in the north of the San Francisco Bay Area, all the way down to San Diego Comic-Con, the biggest event on the geek calendar. All proceeds were to go to the Make-A-Wish Foundation. Participants would run behind a replica of Jabba's sail barge, one at a time, each taking a leg of the marathon distance, swinging a lightsaber for multiple video cameras. I'm self-conscious at the best of times, and I shuddered to think of myself caught on video with a lightsaber. The mirrors at Block's studio were bad enough. This would be broadcast on one of YouTube's most popular channels. I'd have to run and spin a lightsaber at the same time. Was I setting myself up to be the next Jislay Raza? I would have to use that old mainstay. "I have a bad feeling about this," the ominous phrase that features in all six Star Wars movies, but that would hardly be in the spirit of Lucas's positive thinking. The key to that phrase is that it only ever makes the expected disaster more likely to happen, according to Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi co-writer Lawrence Kasdan. "It's certainly been true in my own life," he says. Kasdan, it turns out, is kind of the Saint Paul of Forceology. He may have kept his in-screenplay descriptions of the Force to a mysterious minimum, But he has plenty of his own thoughts on the matter. He believes the Force really exists in terms of being the combined vibration of all living things, something we humans contribute to. His personal religion, so far as it goes, is to believe that there is so much more going on than we can see or perceive, that we're not alone in this space, that everything that has happened in this space is still there. It was Lucas and Kasdan together who came up with the immortal line, "Try not. Do or do not. There is no try." The fact that these words came from the mouth of a green puppet does not diminish the fact that they form a profoundly useful dictum that marries purpose and mindfulness and sticks in the brain for life. A lot of pronouncements in Lucas's philosophy have this kind of straighten-up-and-fly-right feeling to them. He's warned us about the selfishness and self-destructiveness of the Sith, the Jedi's mortal enemies. He's beaten the drum for years on the importance of empathy and our responsibility to one another. Frank Allnutt's Christian tract was right in one respect. Lucas eschews wallowing in mere pleasure for a higher calling. The joy of doing good for others. But he does so in very humanist language. Take this secular sermon Lucas delivered to the Academy of Achievement in Washington, D.C. in 2012. "Here's something I learned along the way. Happiness is pleasure, and happiness is joy. It could be either one. Pleasure is short-lived. It lasts an hour, a minute, a month, and it peaks very high. It's like drugs, like anything, whether you're shopping, engaged in any pleasure, it all has the same quality to it. Joy doesn't go as high as pleasure, but it stays with you. It's something you can recall. Pleasure you can't. So the joy will last a lot longer. People who get the pleasure say, 'Oh, if I can just get richer, I can get more cars.' You will never relive the moment you got your first car. That's the highest peak. Pleasure's fun, but just accept the fact that it's here and gone. Joy lasts forever. Pleasure's purely self-centered. It's all about your pleasure. It's about you, a selfish, self-centered emotion created by a selfish moment for you. Joy is compassion. Joy is giving yourself to something else or somebody else. It is much more powerful than pleasure. If you get hung up on pleasure, you're doomed. If you pursue joy, you'll find everlasting happiness." This, as most of us know, is a hard rule to follow. There are far too many temptations to pleasure. But he's right. The moments we want to remember are the joyful ones, the things we do with and for others. Take, for example, the time I ran behind Jabba's sail barge in full Jedi robes, holding a lightsaber high for charity, numerous cameras on the barge capturing every second for Nerdist. And all I could think was, I needed to do a forward spin of the lightsaber without messing it up while running. I felt as alone as Gisle Raza. Then I realized I wasn't alone, because I was running with the hardcore of the Golden Gate Knights, who'd offered to drop everything on a weekday morning and have a jog in the cold San Francisco fog, accompanying me in violation of the rules. I thought about the joy of doing dumb things for a good cause. I thought about the kid who lost his dignity and the billion people who had laughed with or at him. I hoped that he too someday would experience a moment of joy from having been Star Wars kid. Then, after flailing around with the thing, I suddenly executed a perfect forward spin of the lightsaber, and I thought, "That's for you, Gisle." 6. Buck Rogers in the 20th Century. The fact that George Lucas wrote out, typed up, and then deleted a "there must be a force" scene from THX 1138 was just one sign of the turmoil his one true science fiction movie was going through in his mind. He slashed away at anything that sounded like space fantasy. This was to be a dark debut, in a setting at once futuristic and familiar, but translating all that from the fluid images in his head into static words would be one of the most painful operations of his life, alongside the writing part of just about every Star Wars movie. I bleed on the page. It's just awful, That's how the filmmaker has described his writing style, from his first script onwards. The bleeding began in 1968, when Coppola persuaded Warner Brothers to take an option on a feature-length version of Lucas's award-winning THX short. The $150 weekly checks would also serve as Lucas's salary on The Rain People. That would buy him time to bleed. Lucas was eager to get his ideas on the screen, but desperate to outsource the scripting part. Coppola, however, insisted. A director had to learn how to write. Lucas showed him a draft. "You're right," Coppola said, horrified. "You can't write." They tried writing a draft together. They tried hiring an experienced screenwriter, Oliver Haley. Neither result adequately translated the images in Lucas's head onto the page. And so Lucas struggled forward on his own, as he would so many times in the course of his career. Lucas's talent, time and again, would boil down to this absolute devotion to his wordless ideas, this obstinate opposition to anything that didn't look like them. THX would not get made until the script was as much as 70% the way he'd imagined it, according to his own estimate. It was to be the second highest such number he'd achieved in his script-writing career, after the 90% figure he offered for The Phantom Menace. Lucas scribbled away in motel rooms every morning and evening during the Rain People shoot. Mona Skager, Coppola's script supervisor, was the designated typist for Lucas's early drafts. One evening, she said, he was watching television and began to babble about holograms, spaceships, and the wave of the future. Was this THX trying to work itself out, or something else? One gets the sense of a coin spinning in Lucas's head. On one side was science fiction dystopia, a heavy, meaningful film about who we are and what we've done to our world. On the other side, that seemingly lost space fantasy utopia of rocket ships and swashbucklers. "I really loved Adventures in Outer Space," Lucas would say years later, in response to Skager's recollection. "I wanted to do something in that genre, which is where THX partially came from. But THX really is Buck Rogers in the 20th century rather than Buck Rogers in the future." Lucas was quite literal about that Buck Rogers connection. He would open the movie with a trailer for Buck Rogers in the 25th century. The announcer's echoing intonation of the title was familiar to its audience, having been made famous by the original serial. Director Chuck Jones had parodied it in a 1953 Daffy Duck cartoon, a favorite of Lucas's and Spielberg's, which screened before all 70mm prints of Star Wars in 1977. Duck Dodgers in the 24th and a half century. But in the opening seconds of THX, a redubbed announcer can clearly be heard saying, "Buck Rogers in the 20th century." Most viewers paid no heed to the date. They simply assumed the trailer was ironic juxtaposition with the dystopian nightmare that followed. Not for the last time, the meaning of a Lucas movie would be buried in plain sight. Lucas finally finished the THX script with the help of Walter Murch. He didn't hire Murch just to honor their pact that the winner of the Warner Scholarship would help out the loser. Murch was on his weirdness wavelength, he said. They brainstormed scenes and shuffled them like cards. The result was resolutely anti-story, full of disjointed moments and snatches of dialogue. It refused to explain anything to the audience. The problem that George and I found with science fiction films was that they felt they had to explain these strange rituals, Murch said. A Japanese film would just have the ritual and you'd have to figure it out for yourself. Here's what we figure out. THX 1138 is a citizen in a nameless underground society that has been drugged into sexless happiness by the state. This version of dystopia is far more Brave New World than 1984. No one says the population is unhappy, Lucas later pointed out. It's just that they're in a cage. Robot-faced policemen are everywhere. The masked space soldiers slowly taking form. As are confessional booths with the face of Jesus from a Hans Memling painting. This is the state deity, OMM. THX spends his evenings in front of the holograms, drugged out, masturbating to erotic dancers, enjoying police beatings. His female roommate, LUH, cuts down her own and THX's drug supply, which awakens them. They start a tender sexual relationship. A co-worker, SEN, wants THX as his roommate and fixes things so LUH is transferred. THX and SEN turn each other in for crimes against the state. Tried and tortured, they find themselves with other outcasts in a prison of pure whiteness. SEN tries to organize the group with rhetoric. One idea could get us out of here. THX simply walks out. SEN tags along. The pair meet a man claiming to be a hologram and emerge from the white limbo into rush hour human traffic. SEN can't go on. While waiting to be taken away, he talks poignantly to children, marveling at how small their drug-based learning tubes are these days. THX and the hologram learn that LUH is dead, her name now repurposed for an embryo in a jar. Cars, of course, provide the escape route. THX is pursued by police robots on bikes. Both crash. THX makes it out into the city's shell, fends off attacks by strange dwarf creatures, and then starts climbing up a long hatch toward the light. A robot policeman pursues him, but is shut down when the chase exceeds its strict budget. In the final shot, THX emerges into we know not what world, a silhouette against a sunset. As depressing as it is to watch, THX now seems prescient, a glum presaging of America's medicated couch potato consumerism. Nobody says we're not happy either, just that we're spending much of our lives indoors with a variety of interactive screens rather than holograms. The social commentary was pretty heavy-handed, as you might expect from a small-town 24-year-old living in L.A. in 1968. Here was a man angry at our drug cultures, prescription and otherwise, at a world that had gone plastic and sterile, at authority figures obsessed with restricting sex, money, and power. Some of SEN's rhetoric, "We need dissent, but creative dissent," was lifted verbatim from Richard Nixon's 1968 campaign speeches. Call it Brave New World Meets The Graduate. A month after Nixon's inauguration in January 1969, as Lucas and Murch were still tweaking the script for THX, Marsha Griffin and George Lucas got married at a Methodist church just south of Monterey. He'd proposed just prior to the Rain People trip. The Lucas family drove down from Modesto to attend. Coppola came, as did Lucas's closest friends from USC, Walter Murch, Matthew Robbins, Hal Barwood. For their honeymoon, the bride and groom drove down the California coast to Big Sur before doubling back to San Francisco and across the Golden Gate. Lucas wanted his wife to see the charms of Marin County. He had good reason. Marin was where Lucas had recently glimpsed his future. Toward the end of production for The Rain People in June 1968, Coppola had wriggled out of a commitment to speak on a panel in San Francisco about film and the written word, sending Lucas in his place. There, Lucas had fallen under the spell of another filmmaker on the panel, John Cordy. Over the previous 4 years, Cordy had made 3 prize-winning independent films out of a $100-a-month barn in Stinson Beach. His total outlay was $250,000, and he was making a profit. Once they saw the barn, Lucas and Coppola were converts. They wouldn't continue to be cogs in the studio system. They would go independent. Coppola was further convinced when he visited a commune of filmmakers on a trip to Europe. He nearly bankrupted himself buying and shipping state-of-the-art editing equipment back to the United States. The instructions were in German. To fix it, an engineer would have to fly in from Hamburg. Still, now they had everything they needed. It is hard not to be enamored with Marin, even in February when the Lucases arrived. The San Francisco vistas from the Marin headlands, the world-class hikes, the benign gaze of Mount Tamalpais, over the whole place. This was so attractive that a developer backed by Gulf Oil was planning to build an entire city in the headlands, called Marin Cello, It is probably the most beautiful location in the United States for a new community, said the developer. The locals hated the idea. By the time the Lucases arrived, Marin Chelo was mired in lawsuits and red tape. It would never be built. In stark contrast to L.A., Marin was perfect for a small-town kid. It was all about bucolic small towns, such as Sausalito, where the hippies lived on houseboats. Murch and his wife would move into one. There was Mill Valley, enshrined in a song by Rita Abrams. Coppola would direct the idyllic music video. In San Rafael, Frank Lloyd Wright's Marin Civic Center had just been completed. The futuristic building, with its soaring spire, would feature in THX, and later in the 1990s science fiction film Gattaca. It also houses Lucas's divorce papers. South of Mill Valley was a tiny neighborhood called Tamalpais Homestead Valley, full of windy roads, overgrown hedges, and picket fences. Here the Lucases rented a one-bedroom Victorian with a large attic for $120 a month. They moved in that spring. An Alaskan Malamute called Indiana, which Marcia would strap into the passenger seat, completed the domestic scene. Marcia wanted kids, but Lucas demurred. They weren't financially secure yet. One birth, at least, took place in the Lucas's new home in the hills. While editing his Rain People documentary, filmmaker on a moviola in the attic, Lucas declared their home the headquarters of a fictitious company, Transamerica Sprocket Works. But on screen, for copyright purposes, he used a more prosaic name, Lucasfilm. This, too, was still technically fictitious. Lucas would not file corporate papers until 1971. The next month, Coppola and his crew arrived to start scouting locations for their film company, which was slouching toward San Francisco to be born. Lucas led them around Marin like an eager tour guide. Coppola made offers on two separate Marin mansions, but couldn't scrape together the down payment fast enough. Time was tight. The editing equipment was about to arrive. Cordy, of all people, the Stinson Beach idealist, found a former recording studio in Soma, the most urban, warehouse-filled neighborhood of San Francisco. Lucas argued against it. The whole idea was to have a retreat outside of a big city. But Coppola was holding all the cards. Sorry, George. And by the way, the company name is going to be American Zoetrope, not Transamerica Sprocket Works. American Zoetrope was the epitome of 1969 cool. The offices of Rolling Stone were just around the corner. Jerry Garcia was a frequent visitor. Woody Allen dropped by, as did the mythical Akira Kurosawa himself. Even Stanley Kubrick, the reclusive director fresh from 2001, called from self-imposed exile in the United Kingdom, wanting to learn more about these crazy kids and their high-tech editing machine. The market was obviously on their side. Easy Rider, a film by a motley gang of Lucas and Coppola's contemporaries, was on its way to making $55 million at the box office on a budget of $400,000. Every studio suddenly wanted a piece of the young filmmaker revolution. Zoetrope was it. Nobody thought they were just stupid kids playing around anymore. Coppola was getting $2,500 a week in seed money from Warner Brothers to set up the new company, part of a proposed $3.5 million deal. Warner would distribute Zoetrope's first movie, with an option on several more, sight unseen. Zoetrope would be able to produce the movie without Warner interference, at least until it was done. It was a great deal for the time, made in one brief shining moment when the big studios felt lost and desperate for young movie makers to show them the way. But the problem with the contract was baked in from the start. The money was actually a loan. Coppola would have to pay it back if Warner didn't like his output. Still, it included a budget for THX, the company's first picture. Coppola's lucky number was 7, so he whimsically decided to fix the budget at $777,777.77. A lowball figure for a feature, even then. That summer, as men walked on the moon, Lucas assembled his cast. Robert Duvall from Rain People would play THX. San Francisco actress Maggie McOmey would play LUH. Not for the last time, Lucas used a renowned older British actor, in this case, Donald Pleasence, as SEN, Lucas's crew scoured the Tenderloin for addicts in treatment programs, forced to shave their heads as a sign of commitment. They'd be useful as extras. Shooting began on September 22, 1969, and wrapped 2 months later. Lucas and the crew ran through a hectic schedule of shoots in and around the city. He would have loved to film in Japan to give THX even more of the sense of alienness for American audiences he and Murch craved, but the budget wouldn't even stretch to a scouting trip. Instead, it was a guerrilla movie, much of it shot without permission in the still-empty tunnels of San Francisco's Bay Area Rapid Transit. The pace was intense, the work stressful. Lucas talked about his needle going into the red on day one and staying there. He noticed his crew loading film the wrong way into a camera and had an epiphany. Professional crews can be just as clueless as student filmmakers. He built his own special effects with model cars and $10 fireworks. As for the actors, he let them perform the way they wanted, as if he were shooting a documentary. On one night in a closed set, Duvall and McComey went for it in a sex scene that was risque even in 1971, so much so that it earned a review in Playboy. Lucas wanted his underground world to look a little scuffed and dirty and lived in. The actors wore no makeup. The whiteness of their uniforms tended to obscure this, but Lucas hoped to achieve the look in later films. He was already thinking about a sequel to THX. After all, he'd spent all this time creating this world. It seemed a shame to limit it to one picture. There was one vague scene he had in mind for the sequel. His hero would be trapped in some kind of giant garbage masher. As overwhelming as it all was, and as many difficulties as he had with the crew, Lucas was breaking new ground, and the experience invigorated him. "It was the only movie I really enjoyed doing," he said a decade later. The photo on his THX set pass showed something very unusual in the history of Lucas portraiture, a big, cheesy grin on his face. American Zoetrope was officially incorporated in November 1969. Lucas was named vice president, but the position was unpaid. To make ends meet, he and Marcia took a variety of freelance assignments. Inspiration and occasional gigs from Haskell Wexler, who had recently arrived at Zoetrope, fresh from the August release of his movie Medium Cool, a drama documentary filmed at the 1968 Democratic National Convention in Chicago. Lucas and John Milius planned to do something similar, documentary style, in Vietnam. Milius, mocking a hippie button that said, "Nirvana Now," suggested calling it "Apocalypse Now." He wanted to base it on Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness, having been incensed by a teacher's claim back at USC that the book was unfilmable. It would go through 10 drafts. Lucas was to direct it, even though, as Milius later put it, George didn't know Conrad from Mary Poppins. He just wanted to do a documentary-style Vietnam picture. Before long, Coppola optioned it to Warner without asking either Lucas or Milius. He'd found another parade to jump in front of. Wexler's next assignment was to shoot a documentary about a free concert at a racetrack over in the East Bay. Organized by the Grateful Dead, it was to feature Jefferson Airplane, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, and the Rolling Stones. Wexler had been trying to film the Stones for years. Would Lucas like to help capture crowd footage? Rock and roll on a racetrack with a camera, and he'd get paid? It must have sounded like a dream come true. The racetrack was Altamont. The concert was badly planned and horrifically overcrowded. Hell's Angels were running security. During the Stones set, a Berkeley student named Meredith Hunter started waving a gun on stage. The Angels tackled and stabbed him. The drug-fueled crowd freaked out. To this day, Lucas says he can't remember what he shot. But Albert Maysles, director of the Gimme Shelter documentary that used the footage a year later, says Lucas was responsible for the moody moments of concertgoers in silhouette, panicked, trying to find their way out. Said Maysles, with an odd kind of pride, "It's like a sci-fi scene." Lucas spent much of 1970 in his attic in Marin, retreating to his own cautionary tale of sex, drugs, and escape. "It's a kind of therapy," was how he described editing. Just as well, he despised the regular kind. He had even been irked when Coppola tried to get him to sit down with the crew and discuss difficulties during the THX shoot. Coppola came to visit and introduce Lucas to Gary Kurtz, an older USC grad just returned from 3 years as a filmmaker with the Marines in Vietnam, whom Coppola had worked with in his Roger Corman days. Kurtz, a quiet Quaker with an Amish-style beard, was now associate producer on a road movie called Tulane Blacktop. Lucas had shot with an unusual film stock, Techniscope, on THX. For a lot of technical reasons, Techniscope makes it easy to make a reel of film last 20 minutes rather than the usual 10. For low-budget pictures, that was perfect, Kurtz says, especially pictures with car stuff. Coppola had an ulterior motive for getting the two together. Kurtz was the only filmmaker he knew who'd seen action in Vietnam, which would make him a perfect producer for Apocalypse Now. Kurtz, too, had an ulterior motive. He wanted to borrow Coppola's fancy French Eclair cameras. Given the subject was film and cars and the war, Kurtz and Lucas bonded instantly. Lucas offered to make Kurtz producer on his next picture, whatever that might be, but with the strong presumption it was going to be Apocalypse. For the moment, Lucas had all the backup he needed. Marcia helped edit THX, although she found it emotionally cold even after she was done with it. At night, Walter Murch cut an audacious avant-garde soundscape. Less music than distorted noises, feedback, free-floating electronica. For the prison scenes, while Duvall was tortured on screen, he got improv actors to record ad-libbed lines as if they were bored and casually sadistic air traffic controllers. One of the voices belonged to Terry McGovern, a local DJ and actor who, during his session, would unwittingly create the name for one of the Star Wars universe's most famous creatures. McGovern was in the Army Reserves at the time and was running late from his once-a-month training weekend. So he drove to the studio with his best friend and fellow reservist, Private Bill Wookie. McGovern and Wookie looked pretty ridiculous that day. It was 1970, and like everyone else in their 20s, the two pals had long hair, but for the sake of the Army, they squeezed it into short hair wigs. "We had these huge heads," Wookie remembers. "We must have looked like aliens." Wookie was a pretty hairy guy in general. He still is, and started growing a long beard to match his hair the moment he got out of the reserves in 1972. He had fuzzy red-brown locks and stood 6'3" tall. Believe it or not, that's all sheer coincidence. Wookie has never met George Lucas. All that happened was that during his ad-libbing, McGovern threw out a line for the benefit of his friend. "I think I just ran over a Wookie back there." Memories are fuzzy at this four-decade distance, and nobody knows if Wookie was actually in the studio at the time. There's a good chance the pair were high. "We smoked an awful lot of dope at the time," remembers Wookie. McGovern says he probably just dropped his name to be silly. The wonderfully silly line didn't even make it into THX 1138, but Murch was amused by it, as was Lucas when he heard it. The filmmaker filed the name away in his notebook, where it gained an extra couple of vowels and became Wookie. McGovern kept on working as occasional voice talent for Lucas. One day in early 1977, he would be paid all of $200 to record another bunch of lines that didn't make a lot of sense at the time. "These aren't the droids we're looking for," he was told to say in a slightly dazed voice. "You can go about your business." It was only when he saw Star Wars several months later that he was blown away by the result. "I was paralyzed with joy," says McGovern. "I'm in a scene with fucking Alec Guinness." Similarly, Bill Wookie was blissfully unaware of what had happened until he saw Star Wars with everyone else in 1977. By that time, he had a steady job as a clothing salesman in San Rafael and took his two young boys to see the movie their uncle Terry had been working on. Then he heard the family name on the screen for the first time. "Droids don't rip people's arms out of their sockets when they lose. Wookiees have been known to do that," says Harrison Ford, of his large, hairy friend, who suddenly looked strangely familiar. I definitely thought right away it was cool, Wookiee said. It wasn't until the next few weeks and months that I started getting a little uncomfortable with people making references and assuming I was the role model for Chewbacca. But the embarrassment soon turned into pride, especially for his sons, who began a Star Wars action figure collection that now fills the family basement. When my boys went off to school, they just thought it was the coolest thing in the world, the hirsute clothing salesman, now age 70, remembers. They were Wookiees. By the time THX was ready, Lucas feared his first feature film would also be his last. He knew the movie was off the wall. In November, Coppola came by to collect the final product. After merch screened a reel for him, Coppola shrugged. It's either masturbation or a masterpiece. But if George was happy, Francis was happy. He packed it up for the journey to Warner, together with boxes of Zoetrope screenplays ready for production, including The Conversation and Apocalypse Now. The quirky little THX was supposed to be the appetizer. Even if they didn't like it, the suits at Warner wouldn't refuse the main course, would they? As it turned out, they would, and did. The day Coppola took THX south, November 19, 1970, was so disastrous that Zoetrope employees took to calling it Black Thursday. The suits detested THX 1138 so much they didn't even glance at the other screenplays. They owned this film whether they liked it or not, but they didn't intend to support another. On the spot, they canceled the whole deal and called in Coppola's loan. Suddenly, he owed Warner $400,000. Lucas's baby was a hostage to Hollywood. This was the metaphor he offered repeatedly about his formative moment. You raise a child for 2 or 3 years, and then someone comes along and cuts one of her fingers off. It's okay, they say. She's fine. She'll live. But I mean, it hurts. Warner forced Lucas to cut 4 minutes from THX 1138. Lucas ignored the studio's entreaties to edit more. The studio pushed the movie out in March with little fanfare. Big theaters didn't book it. It got good but tiny notices in Time and Newsweek. Some talent, but too much art, sniffed the New Yorker, calling the white-suited dystopia gloomy and blinding. The film had left Lucas in a bad way financially, and Zoetrope in an even worse spot. The studio started to turn a small profit by renting its editing machines to makers of commercials, but it wasn't enough to dig Coppola out of debt. Then he got a call from Paramount, offering $150,000. He was their third-choice director on the adaptation of Mario Puzo's Potboiler from 1969 called The Godfather. Coppola refused the first couple of times Paramount asked. That was old Hollywood stuff. But Lucas talked Coppola into it. We need the money, he said. What have you got to lose?
Off Coppola went for his date with Destiny. He threw Lucas a bone by letting him shoot close-ups of the newspaper where Michael Corleone learns his father has been shot. Lucas returned the favor by editing another key Godfather scene in the hospital to add more tension.
Lucas badly needed a new project. Columbia Pictures was going to bankroll Apocalypse Now, but got cold feet at the last minute. He and Marcia were down to $2,000 in savings. At one point, Lucas and Kurtz discussed adapting a Kurosawa movie, just as The Magnificent Seven had recently remade Seven Samurai, Hidden Fortress, perhaps. Why that particular Kurosawa flick, the favorite of neither filmmaker? Because it's a fairly straightforward action-adventure through hostile territory, says Kurtz. It's a handful of characters, and it's elegantly told. Perfect for a low-budget picture. Not that Lucas and Kurtz didn't dream about bigger budget fare. One night the new friends were at a diner and looked in the paper to see what was playing at local theaters. There was nothing they wanted to see. They enthused about how great it would be to see Flash Gordon on the big screen, in color. Nobody can remember at a 40-year remove what was said in that conversation or who started it. Lucas and Kurtz were both Flash Gordon fans. Kurtz says they were talking in more general terms about how science fiction pictures hadn't really been enjoyable since Forbidden Planet in 1955. They all seemed to go downhill towards either genre, horror, creature from the Black Lagoon type movies, or alien invasions, or just dystopian stories about post-apocalyptic societies, Kurtz said. And none of that was fun. It was just the idea of capturing the energy of Flash Gordon, Buck Rogers-style space opera, really, which hadn't been done for so long. Whatever was said in the diner seems to have lit a fire under Lucas. On a visit to New York in early 1971, on a whim, he says, Lucas went to visit King Features to inquire about the film rights to Flash Gordon. The King executives agreed to meet with him because they were thinking about the film rights, too. They mentioned Federico Fellini as a possible director. The Italian maestro was also known to be a Flash Gordon fan. Indeed, Fellini was said to have drawn a Flash Gordon substitute for an Italian paper during World War II, when Mussolini banned Flash. No comic strips have ever been brought forward to substantiate this rumor. Comic book and Flash Gordon expert Edward Summer is skeptical. There was no way Lucas could compete with Fellini at this point in his career. This seems to have been Lucas's lightbulb moment. The vague space movie idea he'd been running through the projector in his head for years, there was no reason that couldn't be better than Flash Gordon. After his meeting at King Features, he and Coppola dined at the Palm Restaurant in Manhattan, and Coppola could sense his friend's disappointment, but also his new outlook. He was very depressed, Coppola would recall in 1999, over lunch with Lucas and producer Saul Zantz. And he says, "Well, I'll just invent my own." Coppola paused to consider. What a limitation if they had sold him Flash Gordon. "I'm glad they didn't," concluded Lucas. Not least because, at that very moment in 1971, unbeknownst to Lucas or King Features, a production company in L.A. was shooting a campy pornographic parody called Flesh Gordon, which would eventually see release in 1974. The company's name, in another odd coincidence, Graffiti Productions. Years later, he reflected on why that was. Flash Gordon is like anything you do that is established. You start out being faithful to the original material, but eventually it gets in the way of the creativity. I would have had to have had Ming the Merciless in it, and I didn't want to have Ming. I wanted to take ancient mythological motifs and update them. I wanted to have something totally free and fun, the way I remembered space fantasy. In the meantime, though, Lucas needed a more bankable movie. If Fellini was to take Flash Gordon, maybe Lucas could take something from Fellini. For instance, the idea behind the movie I Vitelloni, about four teenagers in a provincial town who talk about leaving for Rome but never do. What if you followed a bunch of guys on the cusp of leaving a small town and follow them through one night of cruising, a ritual that had died out in the last decade? Lucas would set his version in the summer of 1962, the moment everything changed for him, and end it with a car crash. He came up with a semi-Italian title, American Graffiti. It sounded odd to contemporary ears. The Italian word had not yet gained common currency. New York subway trains were about a year away from being covered in spray-painted signatures. Lucas hadn't intended that debased usage of the word in any case. He meant the word invented at Pompeii in 1851. That means nostalgic etchings. He wanted to record the legacy of a lost decade, an American Pompeii frozen in time forever. The title aside, Graffiti was intended as a very mainstream commercial project. Lucas was determined to combat the perception that he was an emotionless science fiction nerd. It had become the butt of jokes around Zoetrope. "Everyone thinks you're a real cold fish," Coppola told him. "Why don't you do something warm?" muttered Lucas as he wrote, "I'll give you warm." He worked up a 15-page treatment with another pair of USC friends, Willard Hike and his wife, Gloria Katz. Lucas put the word musical in capital letters on the title page. It was a confusing way of emphasizing the rock and roll soundtrack he imagined for the film. Meanwhile, the world was starting to call him. That spring, Lucas appeared in both Newsweek and a PBS documentary in which he railed against the Hollywood system while walking below the Hollywood sign. Lucas's first major newspaper profile, published in the San Francisco Chronicle around the same time, nailed him in its very first line. Those who know George Lucas say that he has the temperament of an artist who works alone in his attic, plus a keen business sense aimed at the preservation of his work. Those two essential facets of his personality were now locked in place and would not change for the rest of his career. Then in May 1971, Lucas learned THX had been officially selected for the Cannes Film Festival. Lucas was the beneficiary of circumstance, a revolt by young European filmmakers demanding that more films by under-30s be screened at the festival. George and Marcia cashed in their savings. No one was paying for him to attend the event, and took off for Europe. They stopped off in New York for a week, staying with Coppola, who was at his lowest ebb while shooting The Godfather, and his long-suffering wife Eleanor, who was 9 months pregnant. The Lucases slept in the Coppola's living room and just so happened to leave for JFK the same early morning Sofia Coppola was born. Even before he arrived at Cannes, Lucas could see his luck changing. While in New York, he met David Picker, president of United Artists, to pitch American Graffiti. Arriving in London on his 27th birthday, Lucas called Picker from a payphone around the corner from a dingy flat costing less than $5 a night. Picker made a $25,000 deal for Graffiti on the spot. Elated, the Lucases took a ferry to France and the train to Cannes on their Eurail passes. They had to sneak into one of the two THX screenings, which were sold out. They didn't show up at a hastily arranged press conference. Nobody even knew they were there. It didn't matter. Only one meeting at Cannes with Picker was to have any consequence. They met at Picker's suite in the Carlton, Lucas's first big-time movie experience, a nice change from the offices of underlings. Picker confirmed the Graffiti deal and asked Lucas if he had anything else for UA. Lucas sensed his opening, and he took it. I've been toying with this idea of a space opera fantasy film in the vein of Flash Gordon, he said. Picker agreed to take an option on that, too. It was the first time Lucas had pitched his dream movie, and he was shocked to find it pivot so fast from fantasy to reality. That was really the birth of Star Wars, Lucas remembered later. It was only a notion up to then. At that point, it became an obligation. Picker, sadly, can't remember anything about the encounter now. For him, it was one of many deal-or-no-deal meetings he had in that hotel. You can imagine how many meetings I had on that terrace, Picker says. More deals were made, more hearts were broken than any level of the business anywhere. What he does remember is that Lucas has never let him live down his eventual divestment from the project. The filmmaker has needled Picker thusly on every subsequent meeting. Hey, David, you could have had Star Wars. On August 3, 1971, United Artists officially registered the name The Star Wars as a trademark with the Motion Picture Association of America. The definite article, as strange as it sounds to our ears, would remain oddly attached to those two more famous words for the next 5 years. The origin of this historic name, whether it harkened back to the space soldiers or was inspired by a more recent phenomenon, Star Trek, is frustratingly unclear. All we know for sure is that Lucas had the name long before he had the slightest inkling of a story. The discussion about the title was that it was Flash Gordon-like, space opera-type adventure about wars in outer space, says Kurtz. And then that kind of gestated into the Star Wars. Patrick Reed Johnson, a filmmaker who became the first kid in the world to see the movie when he covered it as a 15-year-old cub reporter for American Cinematographer in 1977, Gary Kurtz calls him Fan One, is convinced that there's no way you could write about that title and not think about the elder science fiction franchise. The name, before it came out, always got a laugh from my friends, Johnson told me. It sounded goofy, like someone had tried to make Star Trek, but just added the word wars at the last minute. In the early 2000s, Johnson would turn his experience of seeing Star Wars before anyone else into an independent movie called 5-25-77, Star Wars' release date, for which Gary Kurtz acted as producer. It has still not been released. Kurtz says that was a fairly common reaction at the time. Lucas was certainly a fan of Star Trek. He took afternoon breaks during the long years of writing Star Wars to watch Trek reruns. "I liked the idea that you could gallivant around the galaxy," he told Star Trek creator Gene Roddenberry's son in 2004. He was attracted to this show because it got rid of the mundane, boring action of real space and said, "Let's just get out and go where no one else dared to go." Roddenberry Jr. was, ironically, a far greater fan of Star Wars than Star Trek as a child. The original Star Trek series debuted on television in 1966. It was canceled in 1969 after a 79-episode run, short of the 100 episodes normally needed for syndication. But by 1972, Paramount had syndicated it to 125 local TV stations around the United States. Network executives called it the show that won't die. In January 1972, some 3,000 eager fans crowded the first annual Trek convention in New York, snapping up Vulcan dictionaries, books of Vulcan songs, and more than 100 fanzines. By 1975, fans were holding two conventions a year in the city, attracting 14,000 visitors between them. By 1976, there were 4 Star Trek cons a year around the country, with the cast gratefully plucked from obscurity into superstardom. Legendary science fiction writer Isaac Asimov reported from these cons as one might report on Beatlemania, describing teenage girls screaming for Spock. Lucas went to some of these early Trek conventions at a crucial time when he was struggling to turn Star Wars into reality. "He did talk about Star Trek quite a bit," remembers Gary Kurtz. "The show was inspiring in a way. It freed up the mind to think about what it would be like to travel to distant galaxies and encounter other species." Before fans of either franchise get too apoplectic, let me clarify. It would, of course, be an exaggeration to say that Star Wars is just Star Trek with a facelift. The concepts behind the two franchises are pretty much diametrically opposed. Star Trek, as we know from its opening sequence, is about a starship on a 5-year mission of exploration. Many of the plots are fantastical, but it is science fiction, not space fantasy. It is our own galaxy in our own future, using the tools of science to further the progress of a rational federation. Star Trek was more intellectual, Lucas said. It wasn't action-oriented. Still, there's more than a passing resemblance between Flash Gordon and Captain Kirk, and between Lucas and Roddenberry. Both creators used speculative fiction to make political points. "If I went to a strange planet, I could talk about war and race and all the things you couldn't talk about on television," Roddenberry told the AP in 1972. "Kids today are growing up at a time when people are saying there is no tomorrow, that it may all be over in 20 years. Star Trek said there is a tomorrow, and that it can be just as challenging and exciting as the past. It said that we shouldn't interfere in the lives of other people. Maybe the kids saw something about Vietnam in that." In 1971, Vietnam was hard to avoid, even for a young couple like the Lucases, bumming around Europe on a Eurail pass post-Cannes, mostly visiting Grand Prix racetracks. That summer's biggest album, Joni Mitchell's Blue, has a song called California, about bumming around Europe, longing for the U.S. West Coast, but being horrified by the news from home. More about the war and the bloody changes. Later, Lucas would wax lyrical about how the war might have been avoided, the vast numbers of decent Americans who could have spoken out against it but chose not to. "To not make a decision is to make a decision," is how he was putting it by 1976. By not accepting the responsibility, people eventually have to confront the issue in a more painful way. He was extremely sensitive to the fact that the war had knocked the country off balance. Lucas referred to that balance as the poetic state. Lucas was determined now to make movies about the war in three modes: past, present, and future. Absence, reality, and allegory. American Graffiti would take people back to a time before Vietnam ripped America apart. Apocalypse Now, which Lucas hoped to direct before or after the Star Wars, would show it in the present tense. If THX was the movie he expected to get him banned from Hollywood for life, Apocalypse Now was the movie he felt would lead to the government running him out of the country. The third mode that Lucas intended to use to depict Vietnam, the allegorical, futuristic lens, was only just taking shape, but already it was being influenced by Lucas's thinking about the present tense. Though Star Wars was ultimately set a long time ago, Lucas's earliest plan was to set it in the 33rd century. Lucas was fascinated by the notion of how a tiny nation could overcome the largest military power on Earth, and this was baked into the Star Wars right from its earliest notes in 1973. A large technological empire going after a small group of freedom fighters. Back in California following his Cannes trip, Lucas officially incorporated his own brand of freedom fighters, Lucasfilm Limited. The name he'd copyrighted back in 1969. It was just a shell corporation for the moment, and friends were confused by the British-style name. Why limited and not incorporated? The alliteration just sounded better, says Kurtz. And it looked better, too, because the pair were sketching out logos on paper and had the notion that they'd make a big, brassy, CinemaScope-style graphic in which the letters went from large to small to large again. They never got around to it. Whatever it was called, Lucasfilm was barely a zygote at this stage, let alone an embryo. Lucas and Kurtz hired their first two secretaries, named Lucy Wilson, who also did accounts, and Bunny Alsop, respectively. And that was it for employees. Lucasfilm's first legal headache concerned the graffiti draft Lucas had assigned to a USC classmate of his, Richard Walter, who had grown up in New York and didn't understand car culture. Kurtz had already paid Walter most of what Lucas had received up front. Walter fought for weeks to get paid for his desultory second draft. Lucas resigned himself to writing the third draft from scratch. Time to bleed on the page again. There was a way out. Lucas's agent, Jeff Berg, had been trying to sell him as a contract director for months, and now there was an offer. A crime picture called Lady Ice. It would pay $100,000. He could take the money, pay off all the money he'd borrowed over the years from his dad, make a name for himself, and achieve financial security. But he would have to postpone the dream of those three movies. The dreams were just too big. He decided to plow on in penury. In December 1971, the UA development deal was sealed into a memo. It described the Star Wars only as a second picture after Graffiti, despite the fact that the company had just registered the Star Wars as a trademark. Lucas's space fantasy project, it seems, was still at such a protean stage that even the placeholder name wasn't certain. Lucasfilm's first movie deal was incredibly short-lived. Shortly after the UA deal memo was issued, Lucas sent Picker his third draft of Graffiti. He asked for more money for a fourth draft and promised he would co-write with Hike and Katz. Picker says he loved it, but his boss at UA didn't get it. The Graffiti deal was dead, but Picker still had the option to produce the Star Wars whenever Lucas got around to writing a treatment. There followed 4 months of rewriting and shopping Graffiti. Finally, Ned Tannen, head of the youth division, set up to fund low-budget independent pictures in the wake of Easy Rider, agreed to take it on. He was a former cruiser himself. He got that part of it. He didn't get the title. Gary Kurtz still has a letter from Tannen complaining that American Graffiti made him think of an Italian movie about feet. Universal had a half dozen suggested titles. Lucas was writing about his hometown. Why not call it Another Quiet Night in Modesto? Lucas and Kurtz thought that ridiculous. The way we solved that was by saying, You come up with a better title, because we don't love this one, but it's better than anything we've heard, remembers Kurtz. It was good practice, as it turns out. A year later, he would use the exact same line with another set of studio bosses over the title Star Wars. Tannen conceded the title.